who are involved in evaluating these?
Usually administrators are on it, chairs of the departments are on it, and faculty is on it, and if staff are involved in that, staff may be on it.
So not people who get elected, not people who help raise campaign?
No.
They have to be professional people.
No, the makeup and the compositions of the selection committee are, should be the greatest potential faculty representative or administrative college administrator. And there's also a representative of program management team and representative of the community college project management team.
So a conflict of interest would be if somebody was a contractor.
And somebody's in a, was evaluator, was evaluating.
There's going to be a document.
Yeah, we're, the district's coming up with a whole policy and protocol for how we manage conflict of interest. As a first step, we are drafting together with General Counsel's office, the actual form that's the first step. Again, we want people to be honest, but at least people become aware as they're educated on what a conflict of interest is. And then they can determine.
If you'd like to make a call, please hang up and call again.
Technology is taking over.
In keeping with our duties as an oversight committee, okay, I would like to personally request, and others on the board may feel the same way, copies of your corrective documents to read. Because this conflict of interest, or the lack of it, or the way it was handled, is so minor league, I can't believe it. It's absolutely, I mean, incredible that such a thing existed.
Well, thank you, we'd be happy to provide them. One of the things that we've been spending a lot of time on is trying to put them in plain English.
Well, that's always a problem.
Well, the problem is that conflict of interest laws are not written in plain English.
Right.
They're
no laws are written in English.
Only somebody, you know, they talk about governmental interests and governmental decisions, and it's hard to follow.
If you go to the federal registries and use them as a model, they are the best expression I've ever seen, believe it or not. Okay, go to the FAR. Okay, which are the acquisition regulations, the federal acquisition regulations. See if you can model some, see if that helps you.
Yeah.
Except we're bound by state law.
Well, no. I'm talking about format. Yeah. I'm not talking about particulars.
Well, so what we've been spending our time on, it's not so much that we don't understand what legally is a conflict of interest, it's that we need to be able to articulate it so that a normal person reading them could reasonably be expected to read it, understand what it is, and make an assessment. Because if you have people sign something they can't understand, it's not meaningful.
At the end, add two sentences. Really, this is generally done. Make sure your mother would agree with your position. And the second is make sure whatever moral authority you use, okay, be it ordained or not, would feel comfortable with what you said.
Or something like that. Well, you know, I had a law professor used to say, if your grandmother says that's the way it should be, then that's the way it should be. So that's what we're trying to do is make a document that is meaningful, not 20 pages long, but is legally sound at the same time.
Well, I think it's critical for us to understand and for the public to understand who makes these decisions in terms of who's actually selecting the contractor, who sits around the table and scores these things. If it is, you know, heads of departments and faculty and students and that sort of thing, that for me is very reassuring as opposed to a whole bunch of trustees getting together and making decisions.
The trustees virtually never sit and read a proposal except when they're mandated by law to be handed it. Other than that, they would never do that. Let me defer back to.
Well, and that's true. So one of the other deficiencies we found was that there was no formal process for how the selection committee process was names, list given, approved, reviewed, etc. There's guidelines in the bond program's touchpoint handbook that say that the college president should approve who's on the selection committee, but there was no formal process for how that happened. So we couldn't find documentation of the president's approval of the list or how people at the last meeting got on the selection committee. So we've asked, and the bond program management team has now started creating and developing procedures and guidelines and specific requirements for selection committees, as well as being able to offer training to people who are on the selection committees, which is a good practice we found. It's been the last 12 months they've inserted mandatory meetings where selection committee members have to attend.
Excellent.
And they get instructed as to how the time commitment, what the time commitment is and what the responsibilities are for being on that selection committee.
And it sounds like to me, if you got selected for a particular selection committee for a building, that may be the only selection committee you ever serve on.
Maybe. Maybe. That's correct. Depending if you're, you know, building a library and you're the librarian, you have that technical expertise to be on the committee.
It seems to me that in, you know, these committees are 10 people or, you know, some large number of people. I mean, they have one person, okay, with a conflict. You know, sway 10 or 15 people. It's like, you know, can it happen? Yeah. But what are the probabilities of it happening? And the self-disclosure document should, you know, forewarn them that, you know, they need to self-disclose. I mean, Sarbanes-Oxley has created all that kind of stuff in the financial community. And, you know, every person that touches a check nowadays has to self-disclose any problem. So I think you're on the right path.
Yeah, and the good news is that a lot of the recommendations from the audit we recommended have already been, they're in action now. They're being implemented. We will come back to you and to the board probably in the next 3 months, following up with the chancellor now on recommendations that the IG issues and then a status of how those recommendations are being performed by the district, by the bond program staff, et cetera.
Dan? Again, I can only come from my own limited experience at Harbor, but certain administrators sat on almost every committee. I was Dean of Academic Affairs, and therefore I was involved in every academic program of the college. And therefore I sat on every building's committee, as did the project manager, as did some other people. So there was some repetition. But there were some people that only served on one. It had something to do with what your role was and whether you were involved and whether you were the one that's going to listen to who was not happy with what happened.
I don't think the public understands that process, and I think it's important that you brought that up because, as you said, there may be one person, and unless you by the theory of the movie Runaway Jury, it's pretty hard for one person to sway an entire committee. And if the committees are constantly changing and constantly in flux, that's a real protection in and of itself because you get people who are really involved in one decision-making process and then they're done.
Again.
I think the voice of the
person on my word, I noticed in our company, once you have them sign a document, it's self-disclosing. I mean, a lot of questions come up about it. They ask you, okay, what does this mean? And, you know, I mean, a lot of people just become very cautious.
I think the process of signing the document does do that.
Actually, you can go to jail if indeed you violate that.
So as I understand it from Camille, the thing that is holding that up is getting a document that is in plain English that isn't 40 pages long. Somebody can read and can sign.
Actually, we've gone through a few drafts and we're getting close.
We're almost there.
I'd like to ask
you. I would suggest that document would be very simple, okay? And put the responsibility on the individual to ask the question whether or not their case, okay, which would actually give you more and more data with regards to refining that document.
Let me just articulate to you that one of the challenges that we face is that the typical perceived conflict of interest is a financial one. I own stock in this company or something like that. But we believe that is inconsistent with case law and just general good policy. If your brother-in-law's business is in play, that's also a conflict of interest. And at least it creates an appearance of impropriety. And so typically those disclosure forms are driven all about financial disclosures. And we're trying to get to those things as well.
Well, if you go to the airline situation, they ask you, is a member belong to the United Airlines, you know, family, okay? Mm-hmm. So a simple question like that, you know, ferrets out those people.
Well, I agree with Camille's got a problem in that I've been on a lot of boards now, and they've gone from one page to shortest one I signed now is 4 pages, so.
Okay, Reggie?
I work for the city of Los Angeles, and I have to go through, and I just went through an extensive 2-hour online training for ethics. And every time, each year, I have to go through it. And each year, I learn a new conflict of interest that I didn't think ever existed, or perceived or noticed I was actually doing things that I thought was just okay, that had the appearance of impropriety. And the real hard part is the appearance of impropriety. And so that spectrum keeps growing in the city of Los Angeles. From when I used to first take the exam, and Camille is right, it was about money and whether or not my great-grandmother was getting money or was part of an estate, or it was all financial. Now it's become political, it's become a lot of different things. And so not only do you have to create a form to do that, but I would seriously suggest maybe looking at what the city of Los Angeles does for ethics training. And those of us who have some kind of, like, if you make a recommendation, you may not be the final person that do the person, you need to make a recommendation, you fall under a lot of things, but maybe there's some type of online training you can give people also,
right,
so that you can also buffer. So if they do come back and audit,
right,
you not only do you have that paper trail, but now you have a training trail for everybody that sits in these committees that will also help.
Elliot, and then
just quickly, I'd like a comment about another aspect of this. This is not in conflict with anything that's been said, and that is the qualifications of the building professionals, not the voice of the user, not ethics issues, but people have to judge the merit of the company to build a design in one case, and in the other case to have a sound architecture that can be built as well as building the design. How satisfied are you, and if you are satisfied, why, and if you're not, what are you doing about it? That party is represented sufficiently in this judgment process.
Certainly, in design build, I think that there is a process in place that checks on not only personal references by the company,
technical
experience. I'm satisfied in the design build process.
I'm talking about things like having an inadequate foundation. Somebody who's an expert in building could perhaps find that. You know, having something that is likely not to be sustainable after 10 years. A building professional, somebody who understands the process of building and designing and building buildings, how is that represented?
On the selection committee, you mean?
Yes.
Well, the one thing about the quality of someone's work is that anyone can put forth a good resume and give good references and say, we built this building, and you're not going to, for how they're being evaluated now, you're not going to capture that, the past record of performance in the evaluations. One of the things that that other agencies do to try to bring in the, if a contractor over here has started out good and then they perform badly and the inspector said they perform badly and we have, you know, deficiencies on site, that somehow needs to be brought in. And
so it's solely based on past record?
Yes.
It's not based on contemplated current work processes?
No.
Okay, adequacy of staff,
well, because
professionalism
of
staff.
In place for that. You have qualified inspectors who should be checking that, which is actually something that we want to look at in year two, is the what are the controls in place for making sure that the work is being performed in accordance with the specs or...
Well, that goes through the state, you know, review. You know, they can't pass the, get it through the state review board.
Yes, but I think we need to go beyond that.
So when the building... When an RFP is sent out, I assume you get X number more than the committee actually evaluates. What is the winnowing down process before the committee starts reviewing the actual proposals? Or do they just review everybody who wants to submit to the RFP?
No, there's a criteria from the beginning. You have to actually qualify to do the amount of work. It's basic categories like a $50 million building versus a $10 million building. So there's contractors who can only perform at each level. That's the first step. There's a minimum criteria, and there's a big pre-qualification process for design-build contractors. Not the same on sealed bids. Sealed bids, the district actually doesn't utilize a pre-qualification process that they could then weed out contractors, per se, from not performing work. I be looking at that as to, you know, Camille can talk a little bit more about the pre-qualification issue, but you definitely have more of a foundation going into design build, where there's more of a review done on the contractor's past performance.
Without discussing it further, here's what I'm concerned about. Companies change over time. If somebody has done something well in the past and it's testified and it's honest and it's all true, and they just went through a downturn and fired half the staff, and then to stay staffed up with people who are not fully qualified to do this next job, it sounds to me like your current process has no way of detecting that.
Is there a financial review? The company's financials are submitted as part of the evaluation?
But that's...
You're talking about staffing plan.
I'm really not talking about staffing plan. That was an instance. What I'm really talking about is assessing the current qualifications of the builder to perform, not discovering 1 year later through inspection that something wasn't built right.
Typically, in submissions...
I'm asking what they're doing.
I've seen in submissions like this, the key people are named as part of the project team with their resumes.
Yes.
So you could find out whether or not, but if the entire staff under the key people are all new, I don't know that you'd know.
It's qualified. It's less new than qualified. I'm going to leave it as a comment.
Richard has been trying to get in here.
Go ahead. I take it you found the issues with the pre-qualification process, and as you noted, the lack of evidence for quality insurance control and score sheets and what have you, with the design build process, not with the design bid build process.
Correct.
Which I don't know if everyone even knows the difference between those two that are here at the table. People say that. It's much more costly in my experience, and I've been doing this throughout, working in the industry throughout the time when we went away from the California construction or the contract code in the bid process, which was a sealed bid process for the selection of contractors. And when we all of a sudden started switching to the design build process, which the purpose was to speed up the overall construction of schools in most cases, and away from the sealed bid process. And when this whole process first started, the design process included the bidders, who were in general teams of general contractors and architectural firms, who put a bid together with a design, and then that selection was made based on that
package.
God only knows how the contractors and subcontractors that were actually going to build the process were selected. In the 1920s, the contract code was put in place to stop what was going on in the 1920s in California, and that was wholesale sale of projects, relatives, everyone you could possibly think of that had a conflict of interest, ethics violations, which didn't exist then because they didn't have the contract code in place. And now we've eliminated it in many places. It was my understanding that the contractor end of this for the design bid process is still utilizing the sealed bid and opening process as a criteria for the successful bidder on the design build end of this overall process. That's part of the criteria.
They're supposed to be, yes.
Right. The bidders for the design build end of the process, they select a general contractor, though, usually as a team
member. They select the general, and then he then, depending on, you know, he may not select his subs until a year later when design's done. Yeah. And he has to follow a process.
Right.
I don't know that word. We don't check for that process. Yeah, I would just ask him on it. I was going to say, I don't know if the district checks to make sure he's following the process.
One of the things that pushed governmental agencies away from design, bid, build, especially during periods of time when prices were going up dramatically, is there would be this design period in a vacuum where people would talk about all the things they wanted and do their checklists, and everything would be great, and the project would come up with this huge stack of documents after spending hundreds of thousands and maybe millions of dollars, and they put it out to bid, and the bids would come back on a project that had a budget of $100 million, and they'd come back at $200 million. And that kind of surprise is supposedly not part of design build, where you basically have a budget and a concept, and people need to get their design and their budget together before they actually come and make a presentation. It isn't perfect process, but it does save that horrible surprise where you have to literally go back to the drawing boards and start all over on a project because the numbers are so crazy.
Well, not necessarily, because if all of the bidders to a design build process come back with a cost that is $100 million higher than the original thoughts were on the project, you're still in that same situation. And you either go ahead with the project or you don't build it.
Well, the whole intent of design build, one of the values is, yes, it's supposed to save time. It's supposed to be a more collaborative effort between design and construction so that you ultimately have less change orders because you're designing it and the contracting architect and the contractor are a team. And therefore, you should see less issues with change orders or constructability issues between the design and the construction. But as far as I'm concerned, the jury's kind of out because I don't know that there's ever been an analysis performed to show that one procurement method saves money more than the other.
Yes.
I don't mean to be rude, but I think we should hold our questions until the end of the of her report so that we can get through the report and we can ask questions afterwards because we have less than an hour left in this meeting.
Only problem with that is some of us don't know all of the terms that she's using, so...
Well, actually, these are all great questions, and I think these are all important issues because a lot of the audits that we're going to continue to do are going to stem from some of these issues. So I will move on, but it is valuable for me also to hear your feedback because I'm already thinking about year two, what are the areas that
provide it, and one mechanism we have outside of this meeting, so, and I'm one of the guilty ones, we can compress the conversation and listen to what she has to say, is through the advisory committee, which can then meet and get back with you and ask further questions. I think we should use that as a tool because we're all interested. This is vital stuff.
I don't mean to be rude.
That's okay. You're not being rude.
I think we have several new people in here, and I think there's a need of some definition of terms in a report if you haven't worked with them again. I think there's, although the discussion has taken longer than we need to, thankfully our agenda is not horribly long today. I think it has some help, but I think there's some heart in this discussion for for Christine.
Well, I only have a short part left. The recommendations that you can read about in the report, but the gist of most of the recommendations have to do with strengthening internal controls, and I'm confident that they are already being implemented. A lot of the updating of the policies and procedures to go ahead and kind of correct some of the control deficiencies. One of the main recommendations, of course, is the conflict of interest, and you've already heard that we're well underway with the solution for that. And the policy that the board has taken on to direct staff to prohibit rescoring or retabulation of forms once the identification of the design build team has been identified during a scoring process, as you're well aware, because we conducted those other two investigations of scoring, and this is aligned with that recommendation, and that's already underway as well. I do have that I am prepared to talk about too with the remainder of the time from me is I do have an update to the Bandicam information. Last meeting you wanted an update of where we are with the outstanding costs. So if you'd like me to talk to that, I can do that.
Please do.
Before we get off this other subject, I wanted to add a couple of things to the conversation. One, the ethics issue about whether or not someone could affect the outcome of a contract. There are many ethics issues that are involved in awarding contracts, but one person on a committee, the selection committee, can have a very, very big impact because he's not necessarily going to influence 10 or 15 people. If it's close, if it's 5-5, one person, all he has to do is influence one other person and may have a conflict. The other thing is there's a third way that someone could be in violation of the ethics, and it's just that they don't realize it when they fill out a form. So there are many ways and many reasons that a entity should do a background evaluation of someone that is sitting on a selection committee so that they all of their possible ethics issues may be brought forth before a decision is finally made.
Yes.
Sure. Thank you. A question that I have Would we be able to utilize the compliance officers on the campuses to help people understand the ethics issues and kind of,
you know,
just like the selections process for hiring new people, the compliance officer is there to help maintain confidentiality, stuff like that. Maybe they can also help with what Reginald was saying about teaching everyone what the ethics issues are every year. And when you do the selections committee, just briefly go over what the rules and regulations are and give them that paperwork to read, and then they go forward. Is that possible?
Well, I share Reginald's concerns there, and I, like with my neighborhood council that I'm on, we have to do these conflict of interest reviews and what all. And I'm a lawyer also, by the way. And I have to say, even for a lawyer, there are times I get baffled. And sometimes this is supposedly normal English, you know? And I'm there trying to figure, well, is it A or B or what? And then when you get to the legalese, you know, a lawyer has to really sit there and you at times have to just really read it and read it and read it. And sometimes if it's really lost in translation, you have to diagram it to figure out what it means. But one thing they do, and I think is a good idea that you mentioned, is to require that anyone on a committee be required to take a conflict of interest or an ethics course. They aren't long. They're, what, about 2 hours?
2 hours.
But at least it will alert you, and you have to actually do a test.
It's online.
And it's online, and you have to pass it. Now, you have to really be dumb not to pass it. Always go for the hardest answer, you know?
You can't actually not pass it.
Yeah.
But we're actually looking to bringing those courses in. I'm recommending that everybody who's on the bond program be required to take it at least, you know, once a year. It's sort of standard policy for most agencies.
Well, I would say, though, anybody who's on one of these committees is required to take it and has to be verified before they participate in the committee. The other comment I did want to add, though, also was, one person I think can be a driving force on any committee, and I'd be more concerned, this is something I don't know that you can capture, is if you have a particular contractor or whatever taking somebody out to lunch and feeding, let's say it's the theater department chair, and they're talking together about ideas, and there is no money exchanging hands, but there is a relationship. And if that person is the dominant person, they can, in my opinion, and I've seen this again and again, drive the rest of the committee, especially if they get two or three people on that committee on their side by their talking, and suddenly you have a committee going in one direction that's being driven by one person.
It's almost like a jury. Part of the disclosure form includes a confidentiality clause, which you agree to, that throughout the selection process, there's a confidentiality. You don't discuss until there's an actual award of the contract what has happened in that selection.
Vandy Camp.
Anything else before we leave Vandy Camp? Yes,
no,
to go to Vandy Camp.
Okay. Enter Vandy Camp.
Okay, I know which one that I...
What I'm presenting today is an overall update of the total money that from when we issued our report, we reported on numbers through February of 2011 as to how much had been spent, what funding had been approved for the project or allocated from historical recollections, and the total of what the project would cost when everything was said and done. I have, before I go into the numbers, I do want to share, is one of our recommendations from the Vandy Camp report was that there be a reconciliation of costs from the project performed by bringing the information from the CFO's office into the actual system that manages the project, the financial system, which is Build LACCD. That reconciliation has been in process for the last few months. I'm satisfied that it's going well. We've actually been meeting several hours this week with Yaya. Give Yaya a lot of credit because he has a lot of information to transpose over. But the numbers that we're reflecting today, we are in agreement with the totals. There's still some work to be done with the categorizing of expenditures, but for the most part, it's well on its way.
Is this the only project that has the CFO component to it? For this money coming out of so many different pots?
No. Most of the property acquisitions were paid directly by the CFO's office. So, for example, at Trade Tech, we bought 16 parcels But generally speaking, in order to book it as an asset, the CFO's office preferred to tie the property acquisitions money through her office. So all of those projects that include property acquisitions will tend to have that overlap.
So to get them all into the build system, we're going to have to do this to other projects too.
Well, there should be some process in place for a monthly reconciliation of all projects so that when there is a property purchase over by the CFO's office, that they get communicated and then get recorded into the build system. That would be the plan.
Okay, but that's not...
On an ongoing basis.
But that's not the reality at this point.
I don't think it's the reality.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know that it's completed right now. I know that that is...
But that's a goal.
Yes.
Okay.
But that may be only one example. I just know that one specifically.
All right, so I'll try to go through this simply. I do have more information, but it's very detailed, so I think this would be sufficient for answering your questions. Let's go line by line. Originally, we reported in February that to date in February, projects had been expended of $86.4 million. Currently, that number stands at 89.9. And the reason is for the second line, which outstanding costs. We originally reported outstanding costs still of money that either pending F&E orders, pending change orders, which we had estimated at 2.78 something million, and some outstanding contract balances that still needed to be paid for 3.87 million. You'll notice that now in October, that number has gone down. It's the only outstanding costs have to do with contract balances for consultants, which is $688,709. You'll notice the note that we did pay from general funds change orders, a resolution of a construction claim to the construction contractor for Vandy Camp, and that was settled, and that money is out, and that has now reduced the outstanding costs of the project. Their outstanding liabilities, and the reason this is here is this is the money. There's two items. One is the indemnification fund. That's a legal fund that was set up when we bought the Portola property for $500,000, and possible workers' claims that could be $750,000 that may or may never come to fruition. The outstanding liabilities may or may never, they may not get ever paid, so I'm not counting them as outstanding costs. Bottom line is, we estimated in February that the project would, when everything was said and done, would be about $91.6 million. Currently, the estimate is $91.9 million, which is very close. During the reconciliation, there were other early project cost transactions that were found and reported, and some adjustments made to interest that we've been counting, et cetera. The second table just has more to do with the question that you asked about how much was overspent and how do we look at what was originally approved. The original funding allocation, which is sort of transitioning into a budget for the project, was $81.5 million. You'll notice now it is less than that.
How did that happen?
The reason is that the CFO's office originally reported us to count a certain amount of interest that we got through COPS money back in 2002, 2003, over-reported it to us by $1 million, and they've since reconciled that, and so that was reduced by $1 million.
So that's an error in data provided to the people keeping book on this project, is that correct?
I would say that there was a lot going on with COPS. I wouldn't call it an error. It was misreported.
Okay, that's close enough.
Yeah.
That's close.
The other reduction was the original $800,000 that the project got from Los Angeles City College, the seed money, was actually a loan to the project. And it has now been paid back, so it doesn't count as funding anymore because it got paid back to the college recently and it's back in their general fund budget.
So you're saying in February it was not recognized as a loan, not in the financial system?
That is true. We counted it as funding, and then there was information we got that changed that.
Okay.
So that's why that went down, which is a little unusual. So originally we reported in February that we would be $5 million over, but now through the reconciliation, only because we've established that the funding has been reduced, plus we've paid out the change orders, plus we've added the other transaction of early project costs, ultimately the project will be about $10.1 million over what the budget was.
Okay. Why don't you speak next? May I?
Question before we leave the topic. You may.
Oh, I'm on this topic.
Okay, it's on this topic. That's just.
Okay. The reason I wanted to say something is I think there's only a couple of us in the room who were here from the beginning of this particular project. And I just want to say that the original circumstance of this district taking on that particular building, essentially, the old Van de Kamps, for those of us who are L.A. born and bred, a building that had been a bakery and was an interesting architectural relic. At the point where our district got it, it was abandoned, it was defaced and graffitied and basically a pit. And we got it in part because at that time Senator Polanco, representing that area, wanted our district or any education district to take it on and make use of it, and also the community felt strongly about restoring its historic features. And I do want to say that other districts turned it down, I think, before we said, oh, okay, $4 million of state funding, the building, the original building, and that we would work out a way for it to become a satellite to LA City College. In all honesty, I, as a board member who voted at the time, I and I believe others were very ambivalent. I don't think we had any clue that that $4 million would, as you see, barely scrape the surface of what ultimately would have to be done to make it a usable facility. And it is quite beautiful, and it is renovated, and it's green and historic, but at a very high price, I might add. And so I just wanted, for those of you who were not familiar, that is my perspective on how this evolved in terms of our district, and certainly the cost has far exceeded, I think, what any of us imagined when we accepted what at the time was considered a gift to the district, a building and $4 million to fix it. Well, you can see. So thank you. I appreciate a moment for history there.
Are the legal issues settled?
No. Yes.
What year was that?
Was it 2000? Yes, it's over a decade ago.
So
that
the property and $4 million, or $4 million for the property, and
for the property. In other words, I guess the $4 million didn't end up being used for any of the renovation. It was just I need help on those details.
It was actually $3 million, and it was for the property.
The gift, quote unquote, I guess, was the property, and then all the cost of the renovation and construction and everything became ours, and here's what you see.
$4 million.
At $91 million.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, for those of you that don't know, there's actually four buildings on site.
Right.
You know, and the old bakery building, a lot of that would not meet DSA standards once they got into it. So any renovation, as they got in there, they found that there were things that weren't structurally sound and they needed to be replaced. So as they started through that process, they had to tear out a lot more. There was a lot of stuff that they couldn't reuse.
Didn't they even find some stuff underground that they had a problem to renovate?
Yeah, they found all kinds of stuff on the site. So there were a lot of unanticipated things as they started down that process.
My question just was, in 2000, property was a gift. It cost $4 million approximately.
The first property was actually more like $12 million, but the $3 million went towards the purchase of the property. It wasn't intended to cover all.
Okay,
the
it was toward it, and there are four buildings on it. How many?
Well, they weren't there.
They weren't on there at that time. There was only two buildings.
I've been on it since things have been done to it. But then, how large was it?
I don't know how many acres.
Acres.
Ultimately, I think it's about 7.5.
But included in this money is the purchase of additional properties that weren't probably in the contemplation.
The district initially purchased a significant portion of the property and then added, I think, another 2 acres later on to help fill out the footprint.
There was a hand up, and I've lost track.
Excuse me for my ignorance of the issue.
If you've been here for a while,
if you're overspending, where does that money come from?
Good question. Depends.
Which would I would assume would come from more of the Measure A.
That is correct.
The AA and Measure J funds.
So because...
To a degree, if some of the overspending does not come under illegal bond issues, then the district has to pick up some of those costs, or there may be some. Because some of the expenditures may not necessarily fit the criteria of Prop 39 or the bond issues.
Right.
I might defer the question, if I may, to
your report?
Portion of my report. But the short answer is it's in review along with some other things that I'll be explaining, which are also under review.
Thank you.
That might be the better way to handle this question.
So if I may, Madam Chair, then, sorry, Chancellor, if I can defer the rest of my questions then after his report.
If you have questions, you may not have any more.
Thrive on questions.
That's
so.
All right. Where are you at, Christine?
I've completed unless you have more questions.
Okay. I failed to do something at the last meeting because we didn't have a form, and so I didn't even bring it up, and it slipped off my thing. I'm handing out something that has to do with a motion that was presented to me by Richard and some of that committee for consideration. We cannot consider it today because it was not on the agenda. I would like each of you to take a copy of it, and we will put it on the agenda next time if it seems to be there. Is that satisfactory to you, Richard?
That's fine, but Camille, since it was part of the
report
on the agenda, it could not be made as a motion to...
Let me start by reading it. That will help. But the answer is likely not just because of the Brown Act in terms of noticing, but let me just take a quick look here.
While you're doing that, I want to compliment you, Mona, on your double entendre of talking about people when discussing abandoned camp, people who were born and bred in Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Unintended pun, yes.
Okay. All right.
Oh, I was giving you credit.
Oh, thank you.
All right. Where am I on this thing? I know. I'm just looking to see. The Chancellor report, but with that, the Chancellor also sent you people some. Are you going to discuss these as well? Your email about the response to the
yes.
LA Times articles.
Yes.
Okay. That was also part of, I got it as an email.
So maybe we can start that while we're getting a ruling here.
Yeah, I'm going to start the Chancellor's report unless you have.
It's a gray zone. But I think that the point is well taken. It relates to the Inspector General's report.
Right.
What I'm concerned about, and this is just being a little conservative on the Brown Act front, is that it wasn't really noticed. At the same time, since it was in the context of what the inspector, this motion in the wake of the Inspector General's report, I think is defensible from a Brown Act standpoint.
So we can discuss it.
In the absence of the Inspector General's report, I would have said no.
And I agree with that.
Okay, so would you go ahead and pass that? I'm going to proceed with this motion before your report, if we can, for you to review what the report is going on, and I will come back to it, because it takes, unless you want to explain it, Richard.
Well, at the last meeting, this discussion was held as a part of the Inspector General's report that was given to us at that time, and when it was noted in the documents that apparently part of the money that was to be expended on the Van de Kamp project had not been fully approved by the Board of Trustees, I ask if we should not submit a motion to the committee to ask to request and recommend to the Board of Trustees that they provide us with that information. What monies had been approved, what monies had not yet been approved, and what plan under the bond measures were they going to follow that would authorize the expenditure of the further funds? And that's what this resolution goes to.
Is there any discussion? Further discussion? You want time to read it?
And I can read the entire resolved section of the resolutions if you'd like, so that it's in the recording for the minutes. I don't know if I have this number right or not. I think we had adopted seven other resolutions previously, so I marked it 2011-8. But
that's
dropping down to the resolve, that the Los Angeles Community College District Bond Construction Programs District Citizens Oversight Committee, whose responsibilities are to reconcile the expenditure of district bond funds, requests and recommends to the Los Angeles Community College District Board of Trustees that, one, a determination be made that the expenditures made for the Vandekamp Innovation Center project and site have been within the requirements of the bond measures funding standards, and further be resolved that the DCOC also requests and recommends that the funds identified in the Office of the Inspector General's review in excess of those allocated for the Vandekamp Innovation Center project and site be reviewed by the Board of Trustees through the LACC audit, a LACCD audit, and further resolved that the DCOC also requests and recommends that the Board of Trustees provide a financial report on the funding from bond funds that have been allocated and provide a funding plan within the requirements of the bond initiatives approved by the voters to authorize the allocation of those expenditures not yet approved. So a copy of this, if it's adopted, would go to the Board of Trustees for their action.
Does somebody want to make a second to this?
Well, I thought you said that we would, this is not on the agenda.
No, we've since resolved it that it can be discussed
because
here.
Because it's pertinent to what was given out.
Yeah, I think so.
So I'll make the motion that it
you're
be adopted.
You're making the motion. Is there a second? I'm assuming you're making the motion.
Yes.
I second.
Yes. Okay, there's a second to this. Any further discussion? Basically, we're asking for information.
Is there any timing that should be associated with this, like within the next 2 weeks, within the next month?
By our next meeting?
By our next meeting.
Well, I don't know that they're going to have an answer to that by the next meeting. That's why I didn't put a timeline down.
Why, could you explain to me, the Inspector General just gave us this report.
Right. It doesn't say where the money's coming from.
Okay. And this is asking where it fits in the A, double A, and J.
And where, yeah. And that it fits within the bond
so
measures,
what,
right?
What part of, you're asking for what part of the 89 million fits in the A, double A, and J? Or are you asking where is the $10 million coming from out of the A, J, A, double A, and J?
Or where else?
Any funds not yet authorized?
Change the amount.
And allocated, how...
And you need
they
to have,
are
you have
where
the
they're coming from.
How they are going to be authorized and allocated, and where they're coming from.
And actually, the number has to be changed if it is all right for you to the $10,128,000.
Yes. Well, it was somewhat different.
Yeah, it's just
the,
that the
it's the differential. It's the difference is between the $86 million.
Well, now
in that review and the total amounts being reported for the project. So whatever the total amount is.
Yeah.
Oh, wait. So as I understand it, the number that you have in your first whereas. Shouldn't it be 79?
It should be the 79.
Should be 79,845,230. That's what has been allocated to date.
Nancy?
Yeah, wait a minute.
You know,
let me get these numbers straight.
I thought in your other report that it did say the 8 million.
Well, but it's
86,493.
Okay, but the numbers,
allocated.
But what he's saying
but
is
those
the
are
changes.
Expenditures, and what you want to know was between
what was approved.
Exactly.
Right, okay.
And what has been allocated, meaning, I assume that allocated means approved.
Well, I think that's a good question to ask, actually.
So it was the 78 yeah. And the total expenditures.
But yeah, shouldn't it, maybe we're talking about something that is more simple than this, which is at this point, the Inspector General has said that the cost of completion of the project from beginning to end is $91,912 and change, and that what we're asking is how much of it has been specifically approved to date and where those funds have been approved from, and if there is a difference between what has been approved and allocated from bond proceeds to get to this $91 million, where is that going to come from?
That's what this says.
That's what it says.
Nancy.
Yes, the chancellor has his hand up, and then I'll come back to Issa. Or Issa, you can go first.
Go ahead.
Oh, well, you know, we're discussing this, and you claim it's been reconciled as a discussable item. But frankly, I would like to have the coalition
see this, because they haven't.
They will, this will be publicly posted.
It'll be posted.
It's publicly posted, and any one of us...
Where was it posted?
On the website.
With the minutes.
With the minutes, and any one of us can call a member of the coalition and inform them that it has been posted.
Well, one of our functions is to ask the board for information, and I think this is basically what this is doing.
But it, you know, the underlying issue is how much of the initial funds fit within the AAA and J.
That's going to come out when we get the analysis that's been asked for.
I don't think you're articulating it properly in these things.
I think you're asking the right questions for the answers that you want. I don't think it's confusing, except that I think you need to make the number,
correct.
The 79 number, and just ask for an accounting of where the funds came from and what the process was for.
And then not restricted to any bond funds or some coming from other sources.
I think it says that, I just don't think the numbers are right.
So I think that first one, this should be the allocated amount was 79,845,000 versus the expended, which is 91,912. And where is the difference of that right. coming from is basically the
Let's
question.
Change the numbers, whatever is the most current number, because these numbers came out of your previous report.
Right.
Right. You can just use the 79 number, because that's the number that Build is going to be publishing anyway, so that works.
So scratch the 86,493,481 and
that?
Put 79,845,230.
And the difference then would be the 10,128,239.
Instead of the 8 million. Right, up at in the first whereas.
I get lost in the whereas.
So that would be a change to the
motion
and...
Well, the difference actually would be between the 79 and the 91.
Yes.
Because 91 includes, if you want to know how everything's going to be paid in the future, even if it's outstanding, you would want to know how those funds would be, what funds would be applied to outstanding.
So I propose an amendment to the original motion. That changes the 86, et cetera, to 79, and the 88, et cetera, to 10-1.
Right. Is that acceptable to the maker of the motion
Absolutely.
And the person who seconded it?
Wait, I don't think that's right yet.
Oh, damn.
Well, from her data sheet, that's where I'm taking it.
Does the Inspector General feel it's correct?
It should be 12,066,948 instead of 8 million.
Say that again.
12,066,948 instead of 8,818,286. That is the difference between 79 and 91,912. So in effect, it says what's the difference between what's been authorized and where we think we're going to end up.
I agree with Dan.
12,066,948.
Okay, so that first whereas we'll read is determined that there is a differential between the allocated funding, which we're putting as 79,845,230, and the expected final amount that may be expended, the difference being 12,066,948.
Okay, correct.
All right, the maker of the motion, do you accept that correction?
Absolutely.
The seconder of a motion, do you accept it?
I do.
Okay.
I was married?
Yes.
Good.
Wait a minute.
Call the question.
I have a discussion.
Yes. It was good having my hand up that long because most of my questions were answered.
I apologize.
I was going to ask about the numbers. I didn't think they were correct. I think they are now. The other thing that I would say is that I'm not sure that this necessarily is a Board of Trustees directive. I mean, the language is fine, but this is a staff issue.
Yeah.
And
they will refer it to staff.
Yeah, they will. And I think it's already been established that we need to work. This is an implied statement, I guess, with you on scheduling to dovetail your next meeting with board meetings and where we can get their attention on this. But we can do that offline, Nancy, if that's what we're doing.
It's okay with me.
Otherwise, I think the motion's fine.
Okay. Any more discussion? All those in favor of this motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Or raise your hand. All those opposed to this motion. What's the word I want?
Abstaining
from the motion. I would blank.
You raised your hand.
To abstaining.
Are we giving up on that sign-in sheet thing for every
motion
that we voted on and didn't vote on?
I don't know what happened to it. I think we got lost in our change of secretaries.
We've decided it's too complicated?
Well, I don't think it's too complicated. I think we just have to reinitiate it at the next meeting. And thank you for keeping it clean.
So I don't get in trouble. I abstain from any discussion with the Bandicap because I'm actually conflicted
the whole thing.
Good example. No, no, terrific.
Yeah, that's fine. Thank you all for
when
this.
When in doubt, assume conflict of interest.
I want to get the president's report. I would like you also to discuss whether the members of this committee need to be doing something related to possible conflicts of interest. If you could add that to your comments as well. It's your time.
Okay. Well, thank you very much and good afternoon again. Special welcome to our newest members. I hope you're enjoying and will enjoy your run as a member of the DCOC. In reflecting on my preparation for this brief report that Tom asked me to make, I couldn't help but go back in time to some of the earlier communications I've provided to you, a whole bunch in the last couple of weeks. So in some areas that Tom's asked me to talk about, I'll call you once over lightly because you've got them in the packet and I've written to you, et cetera. But let me try to comment on what I think you're anticipating and then introduce a couple of new items that you may not have thought of, which I think will be of interest. I think to begin, in your packet, you should have excerpts from a recent board meeting, specifically October 5th. You should see there three resolutions approved by the board, which I think are part of a now continuing rhythm of change that we see the board need. I can just touch on these briefly for you. The first has to do with the district's decision to invite the city controller to conduct a particular review of the Office of the Inspector General and specifically the selection process for its leader. And I can tell you that those discussions occurred largely between Mr. Santiago, the board president, myself, Ms. Rule, and two of her deputies. They're at the stage where, correct me, Camille, I think within the week she will have completed her RFP process. We hope that will lead to the identification of the individuals who, under her direction, will conduct the review. So that's sort of out of the gate, and we think proceeding well following what I think were very good discussions that center largely on the search process and the qualifications. Two items that the State Controller's Office, you may recall, raised as questions. The next item, so-called BT6, that's a code term for an item of the Board of Trustees and Gentlemen, has to do largely with a master budget plan and policies that would promote oversight. And you see in the resolve four particular items. A little more specificity being sought regarding budget and individual project, more attention for procurement. The third one I want to talk about a little more precisely in a moment. How will we find the necessary funding to address what we expect to be increasing M&O costs? And last, a reporting schematic that the board and I have agreed on is reasonable in terms of this. Your Inspector General just mentioned we're issuing all these directives, but how are we doing? So from time to time, in this case 90 days on these, I'll be reporting to the board on how those work. The last one touches your lives very directly. This is BT7, and it largely addresses concerns that the State Controller's Office, the SCO, raised in that office's audit. You can see that I'm asked to provide timely recruitment. As was noted at the outset of the meeting, I've already recommended some names to the board. They were approved. Just this week, I sent more to the board president. So those are sort of, in process and should be approved very shortly. We've talked here secondly about a representative providing an annual report. That's kind of a pro forma issue. Indeed, when Elliot and Nancy spoke with our board leadership, that item was confirmed pretty handily. And lastly, beyond the presentation of the annual report, it was believed desirable, and thus its inclusion in this resolution, that the leadership of both groups should meet frequently, and the quarterly designation was noted. I will say that when this resolution was presented, there was some interest within the board of a more frequent discussion. And as we proceed, we can look further at that. So, again, as I said when I opened up my brief comments on these, I think that if you have been reading your mail, as I hope you have, you see these as part of a longer-term set of initiatives the board has developed. And I think that's very good. Side by side with this, right around the time this board meeting occurred, I think it was on the 3rd, I issued a moratorium that essentially called for us to take a pause, in the sort of forward motion we have developed about the building program. This grew out in part from a reference in the State Controller's audit that urged the district to reconsider its build-out program in its entirety as measured against the State Controller's set the district's ability to generate the proper amount of revenue on the operating side to fund these buildings. To fund the operation.
There's a concept in there of maintenance, but yes, also filling the buildings with students and teachers.
He was talking about the operation.
Just maintenance, so, right. But he wasn't talking about.
But is it the district that provides the operating funds or the state?
What we have done.
The state provides the district, and the state therefore sets how much the district gets.
So what we have done so far, it's only been a couple of weeks, so the clock is still ticking, is we have reflected on a few things which you should be aware of, but I was enjoying your specificity today in your advice. It's important to look at signs, and I'm grateful sometimes for my education and training in the arts because I'm pretty comfortable with symbols. And I think I learned that growing up with literature and theater and so on. And the symbols here are vivid, they're palpable. You have to look at a $400 million decrease in community college funding. You have to look at this this tier 1-2-3 system that's driving our budget in FY12. The expectation of a mid-year reduction for community colleges. Not to mention, in our own case, the reduction this year of 500 class sections. And the thousands of students we're turning away. So you got that on the one hand. You can quote me in saying that the state is an unreliable partner. The state is not meeting its financial obligations to fund its public education system. So that's sort of in the shadows. I think that the work that we are doing that will, I think, be useful in this moratorium period then includes, as best we can tell, an assessment of what we can expect from the state on the one hand, side by side with very good work that Tom has done in looking at space utilization. How well are we using the buildings we have as we look to more buildings that might be needed? We've got, as good a set of numbers as one can have regarding what's known as energy cost avoidance, given the long-term commitment the board has made to sustainability. And chiefly, as was just noted, it's a matter of trying to speculate within the industry standards what our costs will be in cleaning and operating these new buildings. So I think it's just very important for us to be aware of that on the one hand. On the other hand, some other things are out there which I think are relevant to the justification for at least a 30-day moratorium to kind of review where we are. We're in the process as of this week in placing a posting for the position of the executive director for facilities planning and development, the position that Tom is occupying now on an interim basis. We're poised, as you know, to prepare for the project management component for the Build LACCD aspect of our work. And lastly, I think it's important for us to know that within the week, 10 days, we'll have recommendations from the Building Program Review Panel that I established. And you are familiar with this charge. I've talked to you about it for several times. So there is a convergence then, not only of financial issues, but of contextual issues that I think make those financial issues even more important. So I can tell you that I've begun to discuss these conditions with my so-called chancellor's cabinet, my senior staff. On Tuesday, the same discussion will occur with the primary governance committee called the Bond Steering Committee. We'll give them the same data we just looked at with the presidents and other senior staff. So I'm on a trail to get that input from my direct reports, get input from the governance group that mostly looks at bond issues, and then to the best of my ability, make a recommendation to the board on how I see this juxtaposition of build-out expense side by side with what appear to be the revenues that we will have at hand. The only other thing that I will mention that I think is not in an insignificant way tied to this thorny question is that, as I'll say at the end of this report, I think we're making very good progress, as the British say, in coming through. We're going to have another article or two from the Times. That, we expect that. But I think there are very many visible signs of how the district is really starting now to right the Titanic away from that iceberg. We're doing wonderful things, some of which I just explained to you, that I think will help us get out from under the shadow of being defined as a district by the bond program. And so we should be beginning to think more about how we can take better use of our demands on accreditation, achieving the dream, on private fundraising, on being forceful with the state, with our other sector partners at Cal State and UC, in demanding more attention fiscally in terms of budget policy. Those are the things we have to be thinking about as we're thinking about whether or not we can build out the program as planned. So as you saw in the memo that I know was forwarded to you, we've got 67 projects on hold. With a billion plus left to spend, we've got some already in motion. Those are not affected by any moratorium to date. But we've got some that we feel for at least a short time we should pause and consider.
In your moratorium, are you stopping? Let's assume that for some safety purpose, something has to get done, okay? Like a road or something has to be reconstructed.
Right.
And it's not insignificant. Have you stopped those kind of...
Now, we have a mechanism where Tom and I and the CFO are the body, you know, like a Roman triad,
okay.
You know, would make decisions on emergency or otherwise important issues.
The other thing is 30 days really going to be enough?
No. Probably not.
I would think 90 days might be.
But I think for now I'm kind of staying with the 30. Let's see what happens in the next set of meetings. I know that a lot of people have given me advice about, you know, be careful about how long you wait, the price of construction increases, all of that. And that's not an insignificant consideration. But I do feel that, especially with the progress I believe we have made in improving this program, we need to be very careful now with this next step to be sure that as we plan for the remainder of the program, that we don't get ourselves in financial difficulty that we can't get out from under. I was going to add also that I think we've made very good progress in the last year or more in bringing many of our colleges into the black. The district has had a long-standing history of permitting deficit spending. Debtor colleges, as they were called. Awful name. We still have a couple that are in that category. So I have to also be sure in my effort to promote quality externally through, again, accreditation results being positive, successful student performance measures, all those things that people say are indicators of quality, that we also, especially as we look to securing foundation and other funding, that we can document that with the money we do have, we manage it well. And in my mind, that includes not having schools that are operating in the red. So if, in fact, the build-out means that some of those schools or others that are now in the black would move to the red, I see that as a very important concern going forward, knowing that we must rely in future on grants and private funds because the state, again, I repeat, is not a reliable partner. So that's sort of my my large macro 30,000 feet view of where we are. I welcome your, before I continue, welcome your comments and your questions.
When a school, I really don't understand this, when a school operates at a grid, where does that come from?
Well, they have, what they have is some at the district they have, you know, some contingency money that they put aside. They cover some of that, but, you know, once that's used up, you know, you're in trouble.
I'd like to know which ones they are.
The two colleges that in question right now are Valley College and Southwest.
I, for one, would like to acknowledge the appointment of the Inspector General's office as a key thing that's going to help, you know, weed out all of these comments from the public and whatever, and, you know, determining which ones are right and which ones are, you know, just, you know,
Right, and indeed, I think that the two contract terminations that I wrote, I think I sent you a press release on this, really grew out of Christine's work. And I think that the actions there, again, that the board, through me, has directed me to take regarding possible debarment, possible termination of the two companies, you know, that work really is directly attributable to the work of the OIG. So that's kind of functioning and it's progressing.
The other side of the money question, bond funds are not fungible. So in the event that you decide that certain projects will not proceed and money then remains in the bond fund as a consequence of that, that is they don't proceed because you don't have operating funds to operate the buildings that would be built, what happens to those bond funds?
Well, the board, of course, has the ability to issue bonds, you know, sort of without any temporal restraint. I think that the possible pathway we may be on, and by the way, it's not my decision, it's a board decision. We make that, especially with the board member in the room, make that clear. The board has an indefinite period during which time they could decide to issue bonds.
So they can bank it and wait for a more favorable time.
You know, again, I think that it's a matter of considering those construction cost increases. For me, as an example, you know, I'm not a financial forecaster, but I think if you think about the next year, there are some interesting things happening that could give us more information. Mr. Chung, the controller, would have three new quarters to look at to see what the revenues look like. I think that we'll see with the FY13 what the governor has in mind with the legislature. And as rumored, if November 12 is also a time when a tax increase might be proposed, you got three major indicators that would tell you, you know, what kinds of dollars are really going to be coming our way.
Now, also, the board will decide when the bonds actually get issued.
Absolutely.
All of the money is not in cash in the till.
Yeah, and so, you know, what the hard sell is going to be if we end up going in that direction, I'm not trying to be coy thinking, oh, yeah, we will, wink, wink, but I'm not going to say it here, is that at worst, it's a postponement. It's having the patience to review what kind of funds are available in the climate we're in, but it's very different from the dreams and aspirations that were formed earlier on back in early 2000, 2001, when the sky was the limit, you know, three wonderfully successful bond measures. So, you know, again, I think that, you know, for you, who, of course, with your work are contributing to policy, the budget policy side of this is so important. And so, you know, I just feel that especially because we're making good progress, We don't want to make a slip on a very important thing, which again has already been noticed, you know, by the top auditor in the state. Let me quickly close out with a couple of other things.
Yep. We're getting close to 2:00.
Right, that's why I want to run.
I need a motion, and we still need the report from Tom, and I'd like it. May I have a motion for
15 minutes?
15 minutes.
Second.
All those in favor.
I have a plane to get, so I'm going to leave. Okay.
All right, we still have a quorum.
I can finish in 2 minutes, so you can move on.
That'll be, max will be 15 minutes, and then maybe you can say just as long as you can, and then leave. All those in favor of have 15 minutes continuance?
Aye.
All those opposed? All those abstaining? You're one opposed. All right? Go on. I'm sorry.
I just wanted to say lastly that the building program review panel is completing its work. Indeed, its final report is being circulated this week within the panel. The members are reviewing that for final edits, and I expect to have that very shortly thereafter. You didn't ask about, but I'll tell you that, as you know, the district attorney also has an interest in the OIG, and that office has begun interviews with some of our staff. So we have a continuing audit tsunami. We have one audit and another proceeding, and it's good that that's happening. As I said, I think that the work that we have been doing of late, I think, represents a very, very focused, I think, important work. And obviously what you do contributes to that. So I'm glad to have the chance to report as I have to you, and would welcome any comments or questions or guidance that you might wish to offer.
Yes.
Okay. Back to my question of, when you run out of appropriated funds for a building project and you go over budget, where does that money come from?
Well, that's a hard question because, as you know, there are several fund sources for buildings, and we've already recognized that through the life of the program, some funds came from funds that weren't appropriate and need now to be reconciled. And I think that that's one of the things that we'll look at during this, let's call it a 30-day period.
As this gentleman leaves, I want you to all to thank him for his service. And thank you for sitting with us. Issa, are you going too?
Yeah.
This is Issa's last meeting also. Thank you very much.
Is it your last meeting?
No, I have one more.
Do you?
Yes, dear.
I apologize. I want to try
your service.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
Right, back to my question. So, do you do it through like a loan process that you borrow money from the colleges and pay back, or do you consolidate the bond monies from all the colleges and then start divvying it out and appropriating the money?
You know, it's not quite that black and white simple. I think what we need to do with the projects where we feel we have some overruns is reconsider the bond language, go back and check each college's work in terms of the original appropriation it had to see how faithful it has been to that. And that's the kind of thing, yours is a good question, because it's the kind of thing which we can do during this period to not just look to where we would be down the road, but where have we been that we need to re-examine. And so this is a pretty complicated process, and I think our job is, with Christine's help and the help of other folks, you know, making use of good data to reconcile these questions.
Because it is a concern of us as students. We see these wonderful buildings that are being built, and we're very excited for it. But at the same time, if you're spending extra money, where's the money coming from? And it could curtail a new building being built that we're all excited for, and it destroys the morale of the college. And so that's something that we're concerned about. So.
Justly so.
Yes.
The action BT6 that you presented looks like you're doing the reassessment of all the budgets as the ad hoc committee of the Board of Trustees had directed in any case. And I wanted to, you know, we passed 7 resolutions, one of them being to reestablish the baseline of the overall program. This monthly progress report, who's it come from?
From Tom's office.
But who does the actual report?
Bill puts it together. The Bill office puts it together.
Your auditing section?
Our financial section.
Financial section? Is it? So this is an accurate current accounting of where we are in the overall bond program. The one thing I didn't see in here is the expenditures, or the sale of bonds, where we are in the overall sale of bonds compared to the those that have been sold versus the money that might still be on hand in the future.
So if we could include it,
if it could be included in the monthly review, it would also help us to assess that baseline that we're talking about.
Yes.
That this could be used for as long as we had the total audit on the bond sales versus future sales.
So that information will come out of the CFO's office, so we'll have to get that and post that.
Is the amount of the bond, total amount of the bond, set at a specific number, or is it set at a ratio based on debt service for the taxes that were approved to be raised? Meaning, let's say we're in a very low rate environment now. Are we allowed to underwrite more bonds because our cash flow allows us to, or is it capped at, say, $1 billion and that's it no matter what?
What the bond language allows us to do is up to that amount of money that they authorized. So it's not going over that, but as we sell the bonds, there may be interest off that sale that we'll use on other projects as we go.
But what would happen then is, I don't know that anybody anticipated municipal bond rates this low when this was passed in 2000. So
the tax code requires that when we sell the bonds, we expect to spend them within the next 3 years. So we can't sell them at a low, nice low rate and then just put it in the bank.
That wasn't my question. My question is, when these were approved, there must have been some sort of assumption as to what the ongoing tax rate burden would be to pay them. At 6% interest.
Yeah,
and if the interest is substantially below that, does that mean people are going to be paying at a lower rate?
Yes.
Okay.
It benefits the taxpayers. The district doesn't get more money.
Okay.
That's
the bottom part of my name tag.
One other thing, looking at this thing, you mentioned the fact it would be good to include bond sales. Another thing that's missing, a good thing that's been added to these reports now is cost variance. Okay, how much more you're spending than you plan to spend. Another thing that Tom and I have talked about, and I think you informally agreed to add, is schedule variance. Have you done what you thought you would do at this point in time? Both are leading indicators of problems if the numbers turn out wrong. And you've agreed to include that.
Yeah, it may not be quite in the same format, but you will have the schedule variance for each project.
Okay, yeah, you could summarize at the top, too.
That's the quarterly report that you come out with?
It's in here. If you look now, there's a cost variance in here that wasn't here before.
And there will be a schedule.
But there will be a schedule. No, it's a little bit more detailed than what we've been coming out with for the build program.
We're kind of moving to Tom's report. Is there anything more in the Chancellor's report? We slid. Are you?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. I'll try to do my best, as I have been, to keep you informed with any news.
All right, Tom. You're up.
Okay, so there were four on the good-bad list that everybody wants to hear about. There were four topics that I was going to talk about, and two of them the Chancellor covered, the moratorium on projects, and the other, the considered potential possible termination debarment that we have going forward with a couple of companies. So those I won't talk about. But we did have, and I talked about this a little bit before, about the company that went default on us, J.D. Diffenbaugh. We have four projects that defaulted, and of those four projects, we had one at East, two at Valley, and one at Pierce. And the one at East and the two at Valley, we have since settled those. The one at Pierce was in the design process and hadn't actually gone into construction. We're still working with the surety on that, too. And we should have that settled before long, where we will be able to move forward with the construction company. So the other item that I wanted to talk about.
When you say settled, you mean a replacement company has been brought in and we're moving forward?
Yes, and we're in the final stages of that right now, where a new construction company will come in and take over. And it's with the surety that we're working with.
Okay.
So they're in the final stages of that. The other item I wanted to mention, and this reflects the economy and the way the economy is right now, because I truly believe Diffenbaugh was a good contractor, and they did good things. You know, they didn't cut corners. You know, so I really believe that. You know, it's just the way the economy is right now, and they're a fault of that. We have a liquidation of a surety now, which is still another result of the economy, where the surety has actually been ordered to liquidate, and it's Western Insurance Company, and they're out of Utah. So this is our first with the surety going out of business. So that'll be an interesting thing.
This is a surety we had a claim against, or a surety that just happened to be on one of our projects?
On our projects, okay. Yeah.
So we may or may not have a problem.
We may or may not, and we haven't fully sorted through that process yet. So those are some things that have occurred. And also in UCCI, I mentioned last time, was a company that went out of business. Their surety had taken over the process, and that construction process for that building that's in East LA is pretty much finished. So that one is pretty well settled too. So those were the good news, bad news things that you want to hear. I also handed out status of projects. This is for you to look at. This is design bid build, the small one. The other one's design build. You can kind of tell where we're at as a snapshot there as far as awarded, who got the award, how much money it was. And so this is for you to look at in your time. I don't want to spend a lot of time going through these reports today, because I know we're just about finished with the 15 minutes that we had. So are there any questions on the reports? I hope that you have had a chance to look at the dashboards, because we've added the estimate of completion to those. We'll be adding some schedule stuff also for you to look at, so you can see where we're at in the schedule process. I've already been talking to the program director about that idea, and they're working on that now. So
what is the dashboard?
The dashboard is
this.
Oh, that's what the dashboard is.
Yeah,
it's a very big car.
Yeah. It tells you where we're at in each project as far. And we will be going to the board and establishing project level budgets. Before, the budgets were established at the college level, and then they were allowed to manage that money. But now we're going through with the board has requested, and you guys have requested, that we establish a project level budget. So we are going through and doing that, and that will be presented to the board on the 16th of November at our capital construction meeting.
Thank you, Tom.
For those let me just add, people like Tom, people on the chancellor's staff, if you have additional questions for them individually, you can contact them.
This was included in your packet. We received it last time, and it was discussed. Some of you may not have gotten it. That's why it was included in there, so that you had to read. It gives you some idea of some of the legal implications related to public reports.
Those people must get paid by the word.
Yes.
I have a question for Tom. So.
Yes, go ahead.
Sure. Are you seeing material prices going up? I had a report from a large general contractor a week ago that they were starting to see materials costs raises. Are the contractors reporting that?
I haven't heard it specifically from the contractors, but the industry magazines and the industry articles are saying that there is starting, the material costs are starting to creep up. And a 6% increase, you start seeing subcontractors start to go out of business. At another 6%, you start to see generals go out of business, because things are being bid really close. You know, and so those are some issues that are real concerns. And I actually addressed the board of trustees in April about this idea of, you know, we got to understand that as material costs go up, we're going to have a concern with contractors not being able to perform, because they won't be able to stay in business.
In your fixed price contracts, there's no cost of living adjustment clause?
No. No, so once they bid it, that's why they try and hurry and get things bought before the price escalates. But I think part of that is due to the fact that, not that they, we couldn't manufacture more, but all the manufacturing companies have cut way back on their staffing. It's going to take a while for them to tool up. And the issue that you get into is, as the surplus gets bought up and as more projects start to happen, that starts the inflation process and starts the inflation growing in material costs. You'll see it there first, and then you'll start to see labor costs go up as a result of that. But, you know, people will start going back to work, but material costs will go higher, and that's usually the first indicator.
Thank you.
This week there will be a meeting to work on the this next week's on the Android report and get it off. You will, we'll send a copy off to you to look at. If you have any something that you screwed up on, let us know. Are you going to participate with us on that if we meet?
Yes.
Thank you very much. And how about you, Elliot?
Yep.
Okay. And then you will schedule a meeting for your committee on lost track. The forum for the colleges to give the report,
right,
and anything else that's going on in the next month. Our next regular scheduled meeting will be in December, on December 16th. I will not be here, so Elliot will be conducting this. Mm-hmm.
I have a question.
Yeah.
It's an odd question. How often do we meet?
We meet every 2 months, unless there is a reason for a special meeting, like last month's. And it is usually the fourth Friday, but since the Christmas comes in December, it has been moved back to the 16th.
How come we're getting a report from August then?
That's the August dashboard report. So
how often is this updated?
It actually, every month. September came out just right after the mailing happened. So the December should be posted now.
Mm-hmm.
So the August report comes out sometime in the end of September. September report is about to be published now. So that's the latest year.
It's a month behind. The data comes in and gets collected. It takes a month to publish it.
What month are we in?
We're in October.
October.
The end of it?
So
this was mailed a week ago in order to meet the requirements of the Brown Act.
So the answer to your question is September will be posted.
It's online now.
It's on the website.
And you can get it online. And what we do is we try and send out the most current one before the meeting in hard copy. But as soon as they're available, they'll be posted online. You can go there before we actually send them out. So we usually send out the most current one in hard copy to this committee.
There's no other business. Can I have a motion for adjournment?
So moved.
Anybody opposed? We don't have a quorum anymore, so we are adjourned. And I thank all of you for being here. I thank those who are doing a big sigh of relief that their time of service is over.
Thanks for your enthusiasm.
We're late. Our own meeting, we're late.
It's a matter of
dates.
I'm going to have another meeting.